It's the Burt Cohen Show. The dream requires a great deal of energy. And for decade after decade, we've been relying on fossil fuels. And after the Second World War, along comes this wonderful cure-all called nuclear power. Did you ever see that Disney book, Our Friend the Atom? I know I was brought up with that in the 50s and early 60s. Well, it's not always that easy to harness nuclear energy and to keep it safe. I know you've been aware of that for quite some time. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us today a journalist, Brad Jacobson, who is a contributing reporter for Alternet, and his work has appeared in The Atlantic, Columbia Journalism Review, Billboard, and other publications. His article on the realities at Fukushima is the subject of today's show. Brad Jacobson, thanks for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show today.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
Well, the world, of course, was riveted by the unthinkable size of the tsunami on Friday, March 11th, 2011. And the focus turned pretty quickly to the nuclear reactors at Fukushima. It seems like a long time ago, the widely held perception is that, well, everything is under control. We haven't heard about any problems because the worst must be over. But the title of Brad Jacobson's article is "The Worst Is Yet to Come?" Question mark. Nuclear experts are calling Fukushima a ticking time bomb. Brad, why has it been so quiet? How is it that the world has sort of put memories of Fukushima, filed it under memories, and that it's not a real danger?
Well, you could get into many responses for that, including the media's short-term memory, but the specific nature of why the U.S. government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here, and the nuclear industry, and also TEPCO, the energy company in Japan, and the Japanese government are saying everything is fine is, well, there to ensure people that everything is fine and that, it's not as bad, the event is not as bad as what has happened, and that everything is okay and there's no need to, just go about your day.
Right.
There. Here, experts are saying that the reason why the U.S. government is pretty much just going along with that and Nuclear Regulatory Commission is because the spent fuel pools over there, which are extremely vulnerable, we have 31 reactors here of the same design, and their spent fuel is stored in the same vulnerable manner. And raising the situation that is still ongoing over there would expose the fact that we have grave safety concerns over here. Experts say they have grave safety concerns over here of the same type of boiling water reactors, these GE Mark 1s and Mark 2s.
Mm-hmm. So we want to keep the lid on quite almost literally. It seemed like the lid was about to blow back then. In fact, we've seen some video of the roof blowing off a couple of those plants. How many plants were there? I mean, start with the simple realities on the ground there. How many reactors are there at Fukushima? How many were damaged, and what might the level of that damage be? I guess there's a variation among the plants. How many were there?
There are 6 reactors and 7 fuel pools, if you include the common pool. The most highly damaged reactors are Reactor 3 and Reactor 4. Reactors 1 through 3, units 1 through 3 at Fukushima Daiichi, they were actually in operation when the extreme weather event happened. But 4 through 6 were not in operation, although, and this is why we're in this precarious situation, is reactor 4 had just uploaded highly radiated spent fuel from one of the reactor cores and was storing it in this vulnerable spent fuel pool. And just to give your listeners an idea to jump right into that, so to speak, of the spent fuel and why it's so vulnerable is in these GE Mark 1s and Mark 2s, all of the spent fuel is stored outside of the reinforced reactor core containment, which protects the reactor core, about 100 feet above the ground in about 40-foot deep pools, which are surrounded by the outside structure of the building, which experts say is really no more, in most cases, sturdy than a, say, Walmart building or a car dealership.
Interesting, very interesting. There is the containment vessel where the reaction itself happens, which has a lot of redundant safety and security features on there to keep the reaction itself from melting down, from becoming too hot. But if I hear you right, the spent fuel is stored just outside, kind of in a swimming pool, just separate from that. And that's the case in Fukushima as well as, well, we should get into how many similar plants are there in the United States that have, whether the GE Mark I and Mark II plants here that have similar storage facilities.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, there's 31 of these reactors that have the same GE Mark I and Mark II design, which store the spent fuel in this manner. And, you know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here, they have, because of the fact that initially these spent fuel pools were only supposed to store fuel for, at maximum, I believe, is 5 years. And that was back in the days when we had this idea that we were going to maybe reprocess fuel. And once that didn't take a foothold in this country in the early 1980s, then the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allowed the nuclear industry to store the spent fuel in higher density pools, which really just means cramming them deeper, more and more spent fuel into these pools. And with the idea that in 1998, the repository at Yucca Mountain would be opened, and then that has been held up or quashed or put on hold. And so right now, more recently, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission decided arbitrarily that these spent fuel pools, which initially were only supposed to hold spent fuel for 5 years, are now completely safe to hold them for up to 120 years.
Now, the idea of a pool is to cool it down. You put something hot in cold water, it cools it down. Is that working? I mean, I assume, you know, we haven't heard of any spent fuel pool situations here of getting too hot and melting down. I guess the Fukushima thing, part of the problem was the ground literally shook from underneath them. I wonder if there's a comparison between at Fukushima, the reactors there, the actual places where the nuclear reaction happens, which is more dangerous, shall we say? Do you have a sense of that, the reactor itself or the little swimming pool filled with a lot of nuclear waste?
I mean, according to experts, the spent fuel, you're talking about in general in these type of reactors?
Well, I was thinking specifically at Fukushima.
Okay. Well, as one expert, I interviewed Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to Secretary of Energy under the Clinton administration, pointed out, that's not just totally put aside the fact that these reactors are still an issue, but the spent fuel, the most irradiated or radioactive spent fuel, radioactive isotopes, are in the spent fuel. So there's more radioactivity, more dangerous radioactivity in the actual spent fuel than even inside of the reactor cores. And, you know, one of the scenarios that they're extremely concerned about is that in the spent fuel of Reactor 4, which when the roof blew off during the early days of the accident, there was a hydrogen explosion that blew the roof off, and it sent the building into a list. Now, Japanese officials, TEPCO and the NRC, have said that they have reinforced the building from the list, and but experts point out that even though they may have reinforced the building, it's still structurally unsound and is not up to the grade that it was intended to be, when it first opened. This fuel in just the spent fuel pool in Reactor 4 at Fukushima Daiichi contains as much cesium-137, which is a very deadly isotope, very pervasive, and volatilizes very easily. It contains just the spent fuel pool for 10 times the amount of cesium that was released during the Chernobyl accident in 1986. That's the first case scenario that they're most concerned with immediately right now. The secondary scenario that concerns them the most, which is actually the same scenario that was reported in the New York Times that the Japanese officials were considering when they were considering in the early days of potentially evacuating Tokyo, was if that spent fuel pool in 4 ignites, then potentially that could ignite the rest of the spent fuel on the site. And if that happens, I mean, that's almost an unimaginable scenario where all of those spent fuels together contain 85 times the amount of deadly cesium-137 that was released during the Chernobyl accident.
Wow, there's a lot to ask about there. We're talking with Brad Jacobson, who's written about the realities on the ground at the Fukushima plant, which, you know, there hasn't been a lot of press about lately. But, well, I'll ask about cesium-137. How does it come into being? What is it as it relates to the generation of electricity from nuclear fission? And how are people are not now coming in contact with cesium-137, are they? Tell us about what that is.
Well, they unfortunately they probably are, from what I understand, because it really is very pervasive in the environment. It has a half-life, first of all, of 30 years. It gives off penetrating radiation as it decays, but it can remain dangerous for hundreds of years. But the isotope itself, it has already affected areas and people, because once in the environment, it mimics potassium, and it accumulates in the food chain. And this is one of the main things that has affected people in Chernobyl. When it enters the body, 75% of it lodges in muscle tissue, and including the heart. And it's just a very pervasive isotope. There are other isotopes that obviously are going to be released, but this is the isotope nuclear experts, are very concerned about, because it is just so pervasive.
Now, is it the case that we're talking about a what if, and this could happen, and that might happen, with regard to the cesium-137 and the other highly radioactive material, or is it actually radiating now?
As far as how much do we know is actually in the environment?
Yeah, is it ongoing? Is the leaking of this dangerous stuff into the environment happening now? Or are we looking at only this could happen or that could happen, but it's not happening now? Or is it happening now?
Well, let's put it this way. It's already happened. It already happened in the early days with the explosions. I'm sure you've heard about also the massive amount of radioactive water that was poured into the ocean and had leaked into the ocean. So these releases have already happened, and some of these things no one really knows except for some of the workers in TEPCO on site and the Japanese officials, as far as, you know, how much water, for example, was in the spent fuel pool in spent fuel pool 4. Initially, in the early days, they had, helicopter operators hovering above it to try to verify whether or not there was even any water left in some of these spent fuel pools, like 4, because once that goes dry or gets below the surface of covering these pools, then that can start to heat up, and then that can eventually ignite.
Right.
So there's a lot of question marks as far as what has happened before and how much radiation is releasing right now. I know that one of the experts I spoke with, Arne Gunderson, traveled to Tokyo a few months ago, and took just a few samples and sent them off to a lab to check them, and every one of them, every single sample he took, from different parts of, I believe it was different parts of Tokyo, just ground samples, they all came back as they would be registered as radioactive waste in the U.S.
This was in Tokyo, which is quite distant from Fukushima.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, the common belief is that Chernobyl in 1986 was worse. There was a very different reactor. It was cooled through graphite, a whole very different structure. And that was a worse accident and caused more damage and a lot more radiation leaked. Is that picture accurate? That's what we've been led to believe.
I think, you know, that's another situation where there has been such a clampdown on information. Following this from the beginning of the accident in March 2011 at Fukushima Daiichi, you know, we hear they say everything's fine.
Right.
No, there was a meltdown. No, there was a partial meltdown. No, there was three meltdowns. You know, we keep hearing new things all the time, you know, drip by drip by drip, and it's very difficult. Even the experts that have been following this and, you know more about this than anyone, there are still certain questions. For example, Reactor 3 had, you know, that was also the other most damaged reactor there. I believe the roof blew off of that as well. And the spent fuel pool in Reactor 3 has, you know, a ton of debris sitting in the spent fuel pool. And some of it weighs so much that they're not even clear on whether or not the weight of that had, say, cracked, you know, the fuel pool, and that has, you know, what has happened then? Has that leaked? I mean, there's so many questions as far as the releases of radiation from the beginning of this accident until now. It's very, very difficult to pin down.
So it's hard to say whether the radiation is still pouring out, but there has been quite a bit. I understand water samples taken nearly 400 miles off the coast of Japan in the Pacific Ocean currently show radiation levels of up to 1,000 times higher than previous readings. And there's a question about Alaskan ringed seals and other Arctic mammals that seem to be dying at a surprising rate. So it could be, Brad, are you saying that it could be, well, there was this massive release back in March of 2011, and that release of radiation was then, and now we may simply be dealing with the after effects of that, and as well as the possibility that the pools themselves, because of the reactions that are going on there, could melt down and have some virtually unimaginable disasters.
Yeah, that is what I'm saying, and I would just add to that, you know, again, because we don't know the day-to-day, it's very difficult to take what the Japanese government and TEPCO is saying at face value. So, for example, you know how much water is in the spent fuel pools right now? At different points in time, was there enough water? Was it releasing radiation at different points of time? And they got these makeshift ad hoc systems up right now to put water into them. So there's what you just said is exactly correct, I believe. Excuse me, but it's still so hard to know for sure at each step of the way because of the way that the Japanese government and TEPCO were releasing information, and on the other side of that, because of the way that our own government and the NRC has essentially just accepted everything they've said at face value.
Mm. Oh, what a surprise. you just threw me there with some of that. So we don't know how much water there may be. What about the Japanese people? A tremendous amount of Japanese people have been affected by this. Are they not up in arms about what's going on there? What do you hear from protests in Japan and demanding that TEPCO and the Japanese government tell people, is it safe or not? There must be, I would think, quite a high degree of concern for the safety there.
Well, I haven't covered that directly, but obviously there's been massive protests there, and they just recently, at least ostensibly, the government has said that they're going to go nuke free. Later reports, some other reports show that that might just be for the meantime, and they may just outsource getting their fuel, the radioactive fuel, from places like Kazakhstan. As far as the people there, there's been massive protests, and many polls showing that they just don't really believe what they're being told because they've been lied to so many times. Again, in the early days, when the Japanese government was questioning, trying to figure out what to say, mm-hmm. how to react to the accident and what to say to the public, one of their main concerns was not to, which is a valid concern on some level, not to cause hysteria.
Right.
But it seems that many people believe, and I think a lot of from these polls, many Japanese citizens believe that they went too far in trying to, just ensure the public when maybe they should have been a little bit more concerned about making sure that everyone was safe.
Well, certainly the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has oftentimes been understood to be the Nuclear Cheerleading Commission, really, the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission obviously has no authority over foreign facilities. What's the NRC's role been in this? In looking into it, it seems that they've had some degree of activity. Is it just out of curiosity for Japan, or are they actively trying to protect Americans from any radiological dangers?
Well, they don't regulate, as you mentioned, the TEPCO and
sure.
The Japanese government's nuclear reactors, but there is a correlation, a direct correlation, of who makes these reactors, and the nuclear industry on the whole is an international, operation. So, for example, these reactors are, they're GE reactors. More recently, there was a meeting where I found out through one of the experts I interviewed, there was a GE meeting where the CEO of GE basically spent the majority of this public meeting saying that we're not liable for any of this. So there is a connection, an international connection in the nuclear industry worldwide, and the NRC regulates the nuclear industry here in the States, obviously, but they want to ensure the public and the world that these things are safe, largely for the same reason that the nuclear industry wants to ensure that they're safe.
Uh-huh. General Electric is an American company, and I don't know how the stock is doing. I certainly don't own any stock in there, but I suppose if people are dubious about the NRC, it's possible that they could be interested in protecting the good name of General Electric. After all, they do bring good things to life, right?
Yes.
Well, certainly the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has had its critics in Congress through the years. Ed Markey has been one who's been probably the most vocal critic. He's a member of Congress from Massachusetts, not too far from the Seabrook nuclear power plant. And it seems lately that Senator Ron Wyden, I believe he's from the state of Washington, has also had some concerns. Tell us about Senator Ron Wyden's activity with regard to Fukushima. What concerns has he had, and what's he done about it?
Well, just a few weeks ago, he took a tour of the Fukushima Daiichi plant, saw it firsthand, and it really scared the hell out of him. And he, subsequently sent letters to the NRC chairman, Gregory Jasko, here, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu, the Japanese ambassador to the U.S., Chiro Fujisaki, you know, imploring all of them to get together and make sure that they're addressing this situation, you know, together, and it, you know, just addressing the dire nature of the situation as opposed to just sending out little notices saying that nothing to see here. He was, you know, he said that it was quote unquote worse than reported. He said that the spent fuel rods currently being stored are in unsound structures immediately adjacent to the ocean. And when he was there, he witnessed the only protection was from a future tsunami, he noticed, was a small makeshift seawall erected out of bags of rock. So, you know, and he's the senator of Oregon, and that's right there on the West Coast. And, you know, he considers this, as he mentioned to me through his office, that this is a national security threat, that this is not just a threat to Japan, but it's a threat to the U.S., and it's a threat to the world.
So what can he do about this? It does seem that through the years that the aside from a very few people like Ed Markey and others, Congress has been protective of the nuclear industry. What's he trying to do about it? I mean, certainly, you know, mentioning how it may be a threat to America's security, especially for his constituents right there on the coast. But has he tried to do anything through Congress, or what could he possibly do?
I'm not sure of any legislative matters. I feel like he is the senior member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. So
His voice has some weight.
I'm sorry?
His voice has some weight, therefore.
Yes, absolutely. And I believe that's what he's trying to use. I haven't seen anywhere, you know, or heard from his office that they've introduced any kind of legislation. And I think, really, anyway, realistically, by the time they pass legislation, who knows how long that would be. And he's saying this is a very dire situation that needs to be addressed right now. So I think he's just trying to raise awareness of this. You know, all of the letters that he sent to these heads of state here in the U.S. and to the Japanese ambassador, I mean, he very publicly has each letter on his website, his senatorial website, and so he's just trying to raise as much awareness and get these leaders to act.
Turn up the pressure a little bit to protect the people. And it was such a huge, huge disaster, the tsunami. And I understand some of the detritus is actually reaching the West Coast of America now. I wonder if, Brad, are you aware of any measurements of any radioactive materials that are reaching the shores of the United States?
Well, I know, you know, again, this isn't something that I covered specifically in this, but I know in early days, which you probably heard too, that, you know, it had reached all the way to Wisconsin and I believe New York and, you know, not just the West Coast. But then very quickly thereafter, you know, the EPA decided and other agencies decided that they're not going to take measurements. Now, as I mentioned earlier on to you, you know, with this question of the lack of information and lack of maybe viable updates that the Japanese government and TEPCO were releasing, and subsequently the NRC and what our government may have known, you know, it's the fact that they just stopped taking measurements. And there were some universities who continued to take measurements, at least for a partial part of the time. And some of the studies have come out more recently showing that there definitely was, you know, radioactivity levels that they found, these things called hot particles, you know, which remain radioactive and can lodge in your lungs. And but, you know, again, it's this kind of black hole of information. You know, with the EPA and other agencies shutting down the measurements in the early days, which also, by the way, includes, say, the measurements of radiation going up the food chain in say, fish and seafood.
Wow. Yeah, and, you know, we talk about people, but there's a tremendous amount of life in the Pacific Ocean that we all interact with, and as has been noted, that there are things going on with various different oceanic mammals and fish that are probably being affected by this. I thought it was interesting that you mentioned that GE says, oh, you know, we don't have to worry, we don't have any liability for this. Is that because of the Price-Anderson Act? And certainly not everybody is aware of that. I believe it was made in 1975 that basically allows the nuclear industry in the United States to exist, because unlike any other enterprise, the Price-Anderson Act protects them from liability should there be an accident that causes damage. They are absolutely have no liability. So I wonder if this Price-Anderson gives reassurance to the stockholders of General Electric that you know, they don't have to worry. Or is there some other factor of which you're aware that protects the General Electric from any liability?
excuse me, I'm not aware of something else that would protect them besides that. But you know, there's a reason why no one, no business in their right mind, no one on Wall Street would insure them. Why they, the nuclear industry needs, you know, corporate welfare to exist, and even beyond the corporate welfare, why they need the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do such things as extend their licenses 20 more years, even though these structures were only meant to exist for 40, and there's even questions, and even during those 40 years, they've been leaking things like tritium, and, you know, they're unsound. They found, you know, massive amounts of rust and tons of different types of structural damage. So, you know, I think that, you know, they just wouldn't exist. There's so many, there's so many reasons, so many ways the government helps them to just maintain existence.
Yeah, really, it is amazing. And you were talking about leaks of tritium that happened at the Vernon, Vermont nuclear plant, which was supposed to shut down in March of 2012. But the industry, with its seeming handmaiden, the NRC, is fighting that. And where this broadcast is coming from, there's something called the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant. Here, the NRC appears determined they want to extend the Seabrook Nuclear Plant's operating license, which is due to expire in 2030, quite a long ways away. And yet they're already at work trying to keep it in operation until the year 2050. So, you know, in terms of regulation, they just don't seem to be doing any degree of regulation at all. Do you happen to know if either the Vernon plant in southern Vermont or the Seabrook plant, are those GE? I believe they are. Do you have any information about that?
I know Vermont Yankee is the GE Mark I, the exact type of reactor there. I am not sure if Seabrook.
I believe it is. I'm not certain. But it was always amazing to me. I lived for a while in Vernon, Vermont in January of 1973, and the nuclear plant was right across the street from an elementary school. I just found that beyond ironic. We're talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Brad Jacobson, journalist and contributing reporter for Alternet, The Atlantic, Columbia Journalism Review, and others, about what is the reality at Fukushima? Is it all better now? Is the Band-Aid protecting us? Or is the worst yet to come? And certainly, Japan has had more than its share of earthquakes. It's right there on a fault line, and there's tremendous concern about what would happen if there is another big quake. Certainly the tsunami of March 11th, 2011 was quite unique. It was massive. Do you have any sense, Brad, of statistically or scientifically how likely another quake may be for that Fukushima region of Japan, and, you know, any kind of information about seismic activity there? How stable is it, or is it really unstable?
Well, unfortunately, I have disturbing information about that, and it's in the piece. There was a study published in Solid Earth, which used data from over 6,000 earthquakes, and it confirms the expectation of larger quakes close to the Fukushima Daiichi site. And actually, this is predicated on the discovery during the study that the earthquake that occurred in March 2011 initiated a seismic fault that's close to the nuclear plant to reactivate.
Oh.
So they're not just predicting more earthquakes, but what's maybe most disturbing is that this seismic fault was reactivated. Just between April 14th and April 17th, there were 13 earthquakes of magnitude 4.0 to 5.7 that occurred off the northeast coast of Honshu. Now, that might not be close to the,
I think it was nine.
Nine.
Yeah.
That occurred during the what led to the accident in 2011, March 2011. But, the other part of this, though, is that the experts that I spoke with for this piece is that these reactors are in such a precarious situation that they don't believe that it would take another nine, a massive earthquake to maybe cause these structures to collapse, these pools to drain. As one expert I spoke with said, kind of off the cuff, not in a scientific manner, meaning literally, some people have commented on that, but saying that, the seismic scale of acceptance for reactor 4 should be zero. Because it's so unsound, these structures are so unsound that just the smallest thing could really lead to disaster.
Oh my. The term China syndrome was coined, I think, in the early 70s, meaning that there would be a meltdown, that it would just get so hot and so unstoppable it would melt all the way to China, on the other side of the earth. And it sounds like this could happen. Do you sense that there's collusion in Japan between the nuclear industry and the Japanese government, as there appears to be here? I can't imagine there not being, but I have no information about that.
Well, there was definitely reports, showing that, in fact, I believe it was their own, they did it own in their own internal study. Investigation showing that there was too much collusion between the Japanese government and the energy company TEPCO, and I guess other nuclear energy companies there, leading up to this disaster, and that definitely contributed to the fact that it just contributes to the same thing here, this acceptance that at face value that nuclear power is safe. And they do these risk assessments, and the risk assessments tend to downplay every major risk. And it appears it actually very much mirrored what's happened here. And actually, Bert, I wanted to tell you, because I thought this was pretty interesting. I didn't, in my article, I had mentioned that, after the idea of reprocessing and after the idea of Yucca Mountain was put on hold.
Right.
Or cast aside, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just sort of arbitrarily decided that it's safe to store the spent fuel in these spent fuel pools for 120 years. And I just wanted to mention, because I went to their site earlier today to see this, that the reasoning behind that, and I'm curious of your take on this, the reasoning behind this, and let me quote, the agency's waste confidence decision, quote unquote, which hasn't been expressed in any kind of scientific manner that's been released to independent scientists here in the States to study, expresses the commission's confidence that the fuel can be stored safely in either pool or cask for at least 60 years beyond the licensed life of any reactor without significant environmental effects. And this is how they calculate that. At current licensing terms, 40 years of initial reactor operation plus 20 of extended operation, which is what we've been through right now with, you know, all these reactors being extended, that would amount to at least 120 years of safe storage. That's the calculation that they've come to. I was just, you know, kind of blown away by that.
So that's basically, this is what we have. This is the numbers we'd like to achieve, and therefore we'll make it fit. So, you know, I've seen this in government over and over again that, you know, like here in New Hampshire, when I was in the state Senate, we had the issue about funding education. And the question was, how much does it take to educate one child? And so what was done was they'd figure backwards. Well, we have this much money, therefore, dividing it up by this many students, that's how much it costs. It's the same kind of thing, working backwards. That is, it's really, it's amazing. And what is the, I can't remember the name of the nuclear industry's PR firm that seemed to gear up, and they spent a lot of money in American newspapers after the disaster at Fukushima. But they must be working hand in glove with the Japanese nuclear industry as well.
Oh, yeah. You mean the, I believe it's the NEI?
What is it?
The major trade organization, right, for the nuclear industry here. Absolutely. I mean, they've been from day one, you know, jumping out, trying to get out in front of every new story that comes out of there, saying that everything's fine, saying that...
not to worry.
You know, nothing to see here. I mean, they've been right there with the NRC and right there with the Japanese government and TEPCO.
And so what has the NRC, they've done some looking into it, they try to reassure the American public and the world that if there's no big quake, everything is okay. Well, how, I wonder, just backtracking a little bit, how possible is it that there could be no significant quake, that, you know, if there's no quake, perhaps everything really is okay at Fukushima? Could that be the case?
If there was no quake at Fukushima?
Yeah, no, if there's not another earthquake at Fukushima, is it possible that everything could be okay for the long term at Fukushima?
Well, I'll take that in two parts. I'll respond in two parts. One, the chances of there not being another earthquake, it's in a high-consequence earthquake zone. So the chances are almost nothing that there's not going to be. I'm not saying there's going to be another. The chances are extremely high there's going to be, say, another a 9 earthquake. Mm-hmm. But the chances of not being another earthquake are, I believe, are relatively zero there. As far as here... I don't know if you remember this, but there was a studies done right after Fukushima here that showed that, you know, they which was pretty astonishing and surprised a lot of people, that we have a lot of reactors here that are, you know, right near fault lines or right on top of fault lines, including even here Indian Point in New York, which is, you know, the closest reactor that's closest to the most populated area.
Mm-hmm. Called New York City.
And that, it's not a boiling water reactor, but it is a reactor that is actually sitting atop a fault line. It is, it's 50 yards away from a natural gas line. And there, you know, there's so many, and that study uncovered that there's multiple reactors across this country that have the same problem. But the one thing that I think I would also add to that is that, you know, most of these accidents that have occurred where there's leaking tritium or there's, you know, or even Three Mile Island, you know, these were just man-made accidents. They were just, you know, errors in addressing a situation. So we don't need earthquakes for this to happen.
Right.
Last year when we had, I think it was around summertime last year, we had those incidents where there was an earthquake and there was floods, and you know, there's all kinds of things that can happen that don't have to be earthquakes. They don't have to even be on a scale, anywhere on the scale of something like Fukushima, to put these 31G Mark I and Mark II boiling reactors in jeopardy.
Yeah, it's interesting that they said that the reactor housing, when they were building them, that it could withstand a crash of a big, like a 747 or something. But that was the reactor housing itself, not the outside spent fuel pool, just like a swimming pool filled with nuclear waste. Now, the Obama administration, we all knew right from the start, if we were paying attention, they have been pro-nuclear. Obama is pro-nuclear. What has been their attitude, as far as you can tell? Are they working to learn any lessons from Fukushima, or are they basically going along with the industry in a not-so-subtle attempt to reassure Americans about nuclear power? What has Obama been doing on this?
Well, as you probably know, he's very much supported by the nuclear industry. Exelon out of Illinois supported his campaign in 2008, and I believe that that's most likely the reason why, when he says we need a mix of energy solutions, that he's included nuclear. But then just based on what the Obama administration's reaction is, you have to just think that this is something that they greatly support. In the very early days, I think it was, from what I remember, it was only days or at most a couple of weeks after the Fukushima disaster that Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu said that we're still on board with building these new nuclear power plants in this country, this nuclear renaissance that we've talked about. There was no reaction, completely opposite reaction to countries like Germany and other countries that said, you know what, regardless of even saying we're not going to do nuclear anymore, we're going to shut everything down, just to even say we're going to put stuff on hold, we're going to do they did, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did do these sort of cursory, studies afterwards, self-evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
But the reaction to them, the end result is they haven't really addressed a Fukushima-like disaster, to prepare for something like that. Even the minimal safety upgrades that they're planning are not going to happen until 2016, if they happen then, but that's what they're projecting right now.
Just putting it off, sweeping the problem under the rug. It's a great old tradition in government, isn't it? But there's something that you mentioned in your article called B5B, which, if I understand it correctly, is meant to be seen as a cure-all to make certain that there is enough water in the spent fuel pools. What is that B5B?
Well, the B5B is pretty interesting because in my piece I have a long reaction via email through an NRC spokesperson who assures me that everything's fine, nothing to see here. And in that long response, he repeatedly refers to B5B measures that were put into place post 9/11. And that these address everything, including a Fukushima-like disaster. Well, after 9/11, these measures were supposedly put into place to deal with such things as attacks from a plane or fires. And even then, they wouldn't release what they actually were because, under the auspices of this is national security, we can't release this. Now, after Fukushima, they told the same thing to the press and to scientists that these B5B measures will suffice for a Fukushima-like accident. And they got pressed, and there was a Freedom of Information Act request by the Union of Concerned Scientists to finally get this information released. And they have found, not only through looking at what these measures actually are, but through the NRC's own emails, it exposed staff members who questioned whether or not these measures themselves, questioned whether or not these really suffice. And what the finding was of Edwin Lyman of Union Concerned Scientists was these don't suffice for, earthquakes, major earthquakes and floods and concomitant blackouts. So these B5B measures were largely, as he mentioned as well, and I experienced firsthand while doing this article, communicating with the NRC is they're really largely bureaucratic blinders.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to run a nuclear plant, with bureaucratic blinders. I'm so reassured. Now we must have learned that from Fukushima and other problems with spent fuel pools that they got to have cool water in them to keep the stuff in there from getting too hot. Could it possibly be that fuel pools in the United States still have no built-in instrumentation to gauge radiation temperature or pressure levels? There's nothing to measure that now? It seems like impossible to believe.
Yeah, you would think it does seem impossible, especially after that accident. And when I mentioned before that there are at least some small upgrades that they're planning, or a smattering of upgrades that they're planning, to enact in 2016. One of them is just that. And actually, the NRC spokesperson responded to me that in a very interesting way, that a very roundabout way, that they're going to install enhanced spent fuel instrumentation. But it's a very curious way of really saying that no reactors right now, which I confirm with experts that I interviewed for this piece, no reactors right now in the U.S. have built-in instrumentation to gauge radiation temperature or pressure levels in these spent fuel pools. So, for example, in Reactor 4, the reason why, because it's the same design, the reason why you had these poor guys in the helicopter hovering over the reactor, imbibing all of this radiation, and similarly, the people who did the same thing in Chernobyl, their life ended very early. Yeah. After that, the reason why they were doing that is because there was nothing to tell them how much water was in these pools, and it's the same thing here. So they're saying that we can wait 4 years until we have any instrumentation to know what is in these spent fuel pools.
That's here in the United States. Fascinating.
That's here in the United States.
Fascinating. Well, Brad Jacobson, what do you expect in Fukushima within the next couple of years or so? Is it possible? I mean, it's all quieted down in the last year or so since the disaster. Is it not likely that it will just continue to fade away without any great disaster? Is that possible?
I could only hope. The way that experts describe it to me is that they are, for this article, the experts interview for this article, is they're on pins and needles every day. Mm. They're not confident in the information that's coming out of Japan. They're not confident in the NRC, how they're distilling the information that's coming out of Japan. And they know the precarious situation that these spent fuel pools are in a high consequence earthquake zone. So, obviously you want to hope for the best. But the likelihood of continuous ongoing releases at some point because of the nature of what's happening there, I would say is unfortunately fairly likely, and obviously we would hope that somehow we evade this continuing disaster. But I believe that's why Senator Wyden is trying to sound, and some others are trying to sound, the alarm now.
And I have long had the impression that Senator Wyden is looking at the year 2016. But I may be wrong. I don't know. He certainly has spent time here in New Hampshire. Well, you mentioned the Union of Concerned Scientists. There's Beyond Nuclear. It is an election year, and certainly this issue has not been talked about very much by people. But if listeners are concerned, would those be the organizations Beyond Nuclear, and or which organizations might you suggest that people, monitor on the web and perhaps get involved with?
I would definitely, keep up with what Beyond Nuclear is doing. Union of Concerned Scientists, or David Lockbaum and Ed Lyman are, they've been two go-to guys from the beginning of this disaster of what's actually happening there and how it relates to our own nuclear plants here. Arnie Gunderson, Fairwinds Associates, you know, they're all, and I'm sorry, and one of the main go-to experts in my piece, you know, Robert Alvarez, who Spent Fuel is really an expertise of his, you know, who was from the Clinton administration. All those guys, I would continue to follow on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, the information is, as you said, and as I alluded to the very beginning, when you asked me, you know, why haven't we heard what's going on? You know, it seems like we don't really hear much. You know, the media at large is just not covering this story. You know, why that is, you can come up with many reasons probably why. But they generally have short-term memory. All these experts I interviewed said the same thing, that they felt like they were on a conveyor belt of interviews when the accident first happened, and they all were addressed in the sense of, well, so when do you expect this to come to an end? And all of them, you know, felt like this wasn't going to come to an end for the foreseeable future. But then they're not really being called back onto these shows.
Well, it's old news. People are tired of it, I guess. Brad Jacobson, thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today. And hopefully that we won't be too much more burned by this fire that we've made. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Burt.
And when men gain dominion over land and the ocean, he began to harm the planet with his asphalt and his toxins, and to lay the forest bare, and to poison even the air. And he killed every beast and taught the seas how to bleed. Burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make. What a shame. Then the winds gave in, and the rain with no season, and the sun came to beat on a land of sand and diseases. And when God looked down on the earth and saw it was broken, then the tears of God fell down through a hole. Burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make, burned by the fire we make. What a shame.